Hello, and welcome to the 99s. Sorry for the long one this week. We actually had to cut about 30 minutes out where we spoke about the new RFU risk assessment for transgender players, but that will be the main feature of next week's episode, so keep an eye out for that one. Anyway, here's this week's pod.
Hello, and welcome to the 99s Rugby Podcast with myself, Dan, and my good pal, Dav, bringing you that rugby goodness. Two friends just trying to make a bit of a change to the rugby landscape with your options of sprinkles, bubblegum sauce, and a flake if you'd like it. David, how are you doing, mate?
I'm very well, thank you. Happy Easter.
Yes,
It
happy Easter to
is,
you too.
well, it is for us now. For you at home on Wednesday onwards, we hope you had a nice Easter. Good weekend.
Probably running off that chocolate by now if it's Wednesday.
Hopefully, yeah, I did eat an entire Reese's egg and all the accoutrements in one go.
I also headbutted a Smarties egg and devoured it watching the rugby this weekend in
Yeah,
about 10 minutes.
I watched the Texas Cup this morning and ate all of the Easter egg in one go watching that, which I think is how Jesus intended his death and resurrection to be celebrated.
We said this before. I was talking to you before we got online, didn't we, about the whole lamb thing? Very confusing. The whole thing's confusing. I don't know how eggs come into it. I know South Park tried to explain it in an episode once, and that just confused me even more. But like,
I'll be honest
there's
with you,
chocolate.
Daniel. I don't think we're the people to go into the depths of the mythology of the Easter celebrations.
I tell you who could maybe help us out with that, Dave. Our new friends and partners at the Yarda Collective. Look at that for a segue, mate. Right there, that
Christ,
is
that's unreal.
sharp. Yeah, I mean, I know we mentioned it last week, but that's all official now. If you are following us on social media on Instagram, you'll have seen that announcement come out. We're officially partnered up with the Yarda Collective, our friends out there, good friends of ours who've launched their own sort of startup. So quite cool, sort of linking to us who've just started out as well. They're over there in Derby launching a sort of dry bar, if you will, an alcohol-free venue serving sort of beers, wines, etc. All alcohol-free though, and they've got their online store. So if you visit www.yardacollective.co.uk and go to their online shop, you can sample a pretty amazing array of stuff. And if you just pop in 99 rugby 24 at the checkout, that'll get you a 5% discount, and it'll also put a little bit of money back in our pocket. So you're actually helping us and them out at the same time, whilst also getting yourself some tasty products. Not bad.
Indeed. You can
Happy
also
with the partnership,
find,
Dav?
I'm very happy with the partnership. We said they're a very nice bunch of fellas and look forward to helping them out. Maybe one day we'll hold a function in their bar in person when we're allowed to again. And you can also find a link to their website from our website at the99srugby.com. If you go to our partners page, they'll be on there and you can follow that link and get your stuff that way. But yeah, they offer some good stuff, and I'm going to buy some of their fancy spirits because I like a drink, like a strong drink, but none of the alcohol. That sounds very nice.
In a slightly hypocritical, ironic sense, though, Dave, I'm currently just finishing off a lovely, delicious beer with alcohol. It is a toast. They're a company. They're pretty cool. Well, it's a session IPA that I'm drinking here that they've got out. Citrusy, hoppy, and planet saving. So they're pretty much about reducing the carbon emissions and climate change associated with food production, and they're trying to do that with how they make things. And it's very fresh, very nice. Comes in an orange can, so a big fan of that. And it's called Toast, which
When
obviously has a dual meaning.
they say planet saving, are you sure that's what they mean? Or are you sure it's not they know about an alien threat and they're the only ones trying to stop it?
I mean, I don't know if making a beer is the best way to go about that. Will Smith punched them in the face, and that seemed to do the trick. But I mean,
They've got to raise funds some way.
I know. Well, if that's helping save the planet.
Death cannon's not going to fund itself.
Some guys at Area 51 in one of the hangars brewing beer. But yeah, no way. Hey, look, fair enough. Either way, it tastes delicious. It was nice, and it was obviously a session IPA, so you can sit there and drink that long term. That's the kind of thing I go for in my IPAs. I don't not big on like overly citrusy and stuff like that. I quite like one that you can just sort of chug all night long and get comfortable with. So not a bad one for me. What are you gathering this week? You're not on the alcohol freeze again this week, or are you back
No,
with
I'm
us?
back with the regular alcohols. Actually,
Off
quite
the wagon.
indeed. Yeah, my short-lived sobriety lasted all of 5 days. I've got, in honor of my beloved Rugby United New York, I've got a Brooklyn Lager, quite a sort of standard not standard, but you know, they're a high street beer. You can get them in most good shops.
Yeah.
And no, some less good. And some less reputable shops. I believe it's ironically not anything to do with Brooklyn, New York. I believe it's actually brewed in Sweden. But nonetheless, you know, Brooklyn, New York, love me some Rooney. They didn't play this week, so I've got to support them some way by drinking a beer vaguely related to them. But it's very nice. It's a hoppy lager. And it's tastier than most lagers, I would say. The flavour is somewhere between a lager and an ale.
It's quite a strong one, isn't it? It's like 6%, isn't it? Plus?
It's 5.2. So 5.2. It's okay. Stronger than your average beer. Or average lager.
Not bad, though. Well, obviously, we're recording on Sunday. Again, like you said, Easter's here, so it's not a school night either. So, you know, there's no need to just limit ourselves to one. We can enjoy a couple this evening because
we could.
No early rise tomorrow. But like I mentioned before, I'm definitely going to have to get up and do some jogging tomorrow. I smashed some macaroni cheese earlier on as well, like homemade, and some beef kofta type thing. So it's pretty stuffed right now. Leaning back in the office chair here, having a good time. Excited to talk some rugby, man. We've got a pretty good agenda here tonight. Quite exciting, really. Obviously, you know, got our regular headlines and such. We're sort of doing a bit of a women's rugby focus tonight as well, which is cool. And then the MLR roundup from this week, you know, like you said, just a few games this weekend. But obviously, we've got our prediction challenge from last week. We've got to go head to head, see who won that. And I presume some sort of forfeit for the loser. But first off, man, jumping on the headlines. So just obviously like the big headline for the weekend, the biggest thing that's been going on European Cup wise, you know, some pretty mad scores out there, some pretty good games. Do you catch any? See anything interesting? Anything take your eye?
I didn't actually watch much rugby this weekend. I saw the Clermont Wasps game, which had many, many tries, but through leaving the room and just occasionally not paying attention, missed every single try. So my European rugby weekend was not particularly busy. I did watch the Women's Six Nations. I watched quite a lot of rugby league this weekend, actually. The NRL was on and the Super League was on. I watched that instead. I don't know why. I don't normally care that much, at least not for the Super League. NRL was okay. But yeah, I enjoyed that, though.
Fair enough. But I mean, now what games did I catch? I caught Munster Toulouse, which was a really good game. 40-33 to lose away. You know, not many people win at Thomond Park, so that was a pretty good result for them. Really interesting game as well. Joey Carberry looked quite sharp coming back after a long injury layoff. Cheslin Colby picked up some litter off the pitch after the game, so, you know, good on him as well. But, you know, pretty entertaining one back and forth. I settled in and watched Tigers play Connacht as well in the Challenge Cup, in the Poo Cup.
My grandma calls it the Mickey Mouse Cup. She's a season ticket holder down at Tigers. But she was glad to see them score some points.
Yeah, but I tell you what, like, still like too many basic errors for guys who are premiership level, like elite level players. Like three of Connacht's tries came from like pick and goes around the fringes and running it in from like 30 meters. That's no good. You can't be getting done around guard like that easily. Do you know what I mean? So that was a bit disappointing. But there's some big ones there. I think, you know, Exeter looks strong as well in the Heineken Cup. But I don't know. I think at the moment probably going to look in at I think they've got Leinster because obviously Toulon had to cry out the cup. They got their game cancelled. Classic like Saturday rugby when one team doesn't turn up with enough players, the game gets forfeited because half of them had COVID or something like that. So, you know, they're out. So Leinster are going to be fresh for that game with Chiefs this weekend. That could be a really tough one at the quarterfinals. But, you know, probably going to say that, you know, the likes of your Toulouse will be getting to the final. But 5 out of 8 quarterfinalists are French teams, man. I mean, we're struggling a bit with the British Isles competing at that level, it looks like, really.
Just a lot of fixes, isn't it? I mean, I know the top 14 is the same issue, but it's a disrupted season, but it's a lot of rugby to be playing, is it? It's either just the guys who are in the Six Nations now coming back to play again. They've got to step up that level. I mean, I think French rugby, they've got a fair bit of cash behind it, I guess. They're always strong in European competitions, but not too much of a surprise. So I caught the end of like the roundup thing and saw a few of the results. It's a shame that any of the Welsh teams have made it through, have they? Or any of the Scottish teams? Is it just English, Irish and French?
Yeah. And I saw in the cup there as well, the last game,
I think it was, I know Ulster are playing Quins now in the Challenge Cup, but in the Heineken Cup, I think Scarlets were playing Sale. Was that
Challenge Cup? I think that was Champions Cup. And so yeah,
Sale absolutely smashed them by the look of it.
So.
They were 13-0 up when I turned it off. So
yeah.
I'm getting ready for this, but yeah, not great.
When we're on the topic of European rugby, and it's the Chiefs, and I just noticed watching the roundup that Exeter have that like gold European kit, and they always wear a European kit. And most of the teams have like a special European kit. Where do you stand on that? Because I think you should wear your home colours. Like Exeter plain white. I think they should play in white in Europe. I just think for me, like, the colours are your identity. And I find it strange when clubs do that. Maybe it's a marketing opportunity. Or just go, oh, we've got a cool kit. But a lot of teams do it. And I just think, wear your home colours. It's special to see those colours in those big games, I think.
Yeah, I guess you pretty much banged the nail on the head, mate. I think it's just a market and opportunity. It's a chance to put another kit out there and maybe get a little bit more income from fans buying it. And yeah, it's just quite nice, isn't it? There's some really nice ones there. I mean, you know, there's some great kits anyway. But yeah, you don't tend to see it with a few of the other clubs. It tends to be sort of more sort of the British clubs by the look of it, really. I don't see many of the French clubs wearing anything too dissimilar.
No, I see the French clubs normally wear their normal kit. And I remember Tigers have never had a special kit, but a few of them, I think the Irish teams have done it a couple of times, Leinster have done it, Exeter, I think we've always done it. Cardiff had that pink kit, which I'm not sure if that was the Europe-only thing or they had that for a while. It looked cool, but I think, you know, your colours are your colours. I think you shouldn't be messing around.
Yeah, some of the shirts are nice, though. Like, again, it is a bit of a spinner. Like football clubs do it a lot, don't they? Football clubs have, like, a third kit quite a lot, and you'll see that they wear it in, like, the Champions League and, you know, Europa League and stuff like that, so... I guess like it's just one of those footballisms, if you want to call it that. It's maybe come into rugby a little bit, an extra sort of money spinner. So good on you if it makes you your money, but Dav's called it. Have a bit more tradition, perhaps.
Yeah, I'm a traditional man in very few ways, but this is one of them.
but yeah, overall, I guess pretty sound weekend of Heineken Cup rugby. You know, the quarterfinals are on next week. We'll probably check in on them, have a little chat after that. But I think probably, you know, you're looking at the likes of Toulouse looked pretty strong for it overall. I know Munster gave them a really good run in there, but, you know, it was kind of like a heavyweight punch for punch kind of fight, and Toulouse managed to stand up to everything, you know, Munster threw and rode the wave there. So fair play to them. They looked pretty strong for it. I mean, Sale, yes, they played Kenefly today, but they looked pretty handy from what I saw, really sort of dynamic and quite bullying with their decent pack. You know, they seem to be firing pretty well now under Sanderson. So it could be a decent quarterfinal stage, but I can't really look too much past Toulouse and, you know, Leinster exit is probably like your game of the weekend, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think, yeah, Toulouse looked very strong sort of after a few years off the pace a bit. Which I think it's good to see, but they're probably European powerhouse. The same way like Toulouse and like Tigers, you want them to be up there. And it's not nice to see them when they aren't doing too well. So Leinster exit, that could easily be a final. Although with the teams that are left, like, yeah, and even could easily be final, with the exception possibly Sale. But I'd quite like to see Sale go and win it, actually. That'd be quite nice. I think they're probably
Bordeaux-Begler looked handy today. They sort of dispatched Bristol pretty well. Bit of a controversial game as well. A few sort of like arguable red cards and stuff like that. I mean, I didn't sit on the side of that. It was what it was. You know, a couple of knock-ons didn't go Bristol's way by the look of it, and a couple of tries resulted from it. But yeah, all in all, pretty entertaining weekend of rugby. Lots of high-scoring points. I mean, maybe there's something to be said for the rugby season actually starting later, because we're playing a lot more games in this dry kind of weather. We've seen a lot better games, a lot better score lines. We've not played as many games in like -2 pissing down rain. So maybe there's something to be said of the season starting a little bit later or having a break around the shitty weather.
I think a break maybe the best way to go. You get some good stuff in like September. Maybe say you get to December, call it quits, come back, sort of start the Six Nations and you stagger it, I guess, because you've got they play late anyway, they play well into June, so I don't think it means that bad to just have more games in this period. Maybe you just don't have like a premiership break during the Six Nations, you just put out your second strings. But I think you get better rugby, it's just better to watch. You know, like 7-3 board games in say like sideways rain.
While we're on the topic of Europe, then I guess, have you seen that the European finals are not being played at the Marseille Stadium? Was it Stade Vélodrome?
That is the name of the stadium in Marseille. It's a very, imposing stadium. Great piece of architecture if we want to sound
perfect
a bit wanky. It's okay. It's a great place, great place to hold the final. It's a shame they won't. What's their reasoning? Is it just that France is like more at risk of COVID? Because it's looking like it's going to be French teams probably in it, and then you think,
France are currently having a sort of rise and spike in their COVID cases, and with the final supposedly being in around May, isn't it usually? They've sort of, I think they've said, let's not bother again. So you know, it's one of them, isn't it? Really, I mean,
say what. How many fans is there then?
It's more likely that there's going to be. It's more likely that there's going to be fans here because I've seen this week that there's going to be 4,000 fans let in for the FA Cup semi-finals, like local residents.
I believe so, yeah. I mean,
and 8,000 at the Carabao Cup final, I've heard, or something like that. So people are coming back in, and you know, it's being played at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, which is brand new state of the art ground.
Right.
Not too similar. Great place. Nice bit of architecture itself.
It is. It's a very. So this time we've got the Napa as modern grounds now, and they're actually making them like have a bit of personality. Mm. And then all those new grounds they've sort of built around the turn of the millennium, they're like, they're just cut and paste. Nice to see they've got the hang of it now. And they have those my favourite thing about the Tottenham Stadium is those beers that fill from the bottom.
Yeah, fancy. Fancy.
I don't know how they do it. It blew my mind. My tiny monkey brain couldn't handle it. But to be honest with you, I'm not sure how you put stairs into a two-story house. I don't know, do you build the stairs first or the second floor first? Not does they much to impress me.
Don't send me down this rabbit hole of trying to explain things. I get confused by tying my shoelaces some days. So let's ease upon that. But you know, that's Europe in a nutshell, I guess. You know, pretty exciting that it's going to be at Tottenham Hotspur's ground, because I know that they're talking about that being a possible sort of future venue, maybe for some smaller international games and stuff like that, which I'm sure we'll maybe talk about that in the future. Maybe England could play a smaller nation there, weighing up those options, possibly, who knows. You know, England versus Spain or something like that, maybe there at some point. Who knows? But good for North London. And obviously good that the final's going to be in England. It's an increased revenue after this tough time to get some money back into us, and a bit poo for the French. But that's what happens when you go for waffles left, right, and centre, guys. Behave yourselves. Stay locked in. Shouldn't have even been allowed to play that last game if we were being harsh on the rules, as much as I wanted to see it. Just saying. No hate, but you know, hopefully they can sort it out a little bit, stem that tide of COVID there, because it's not great. Europe done. Bang the gavel. Next bit of news. Bit of a smirchy one in the end. I saw earlier this week that Mike Brown was leaving Quinns, and we sort of had a quick chat about that. And then today, an article's come out in the newspapers, I think it's the Daily Mail, him having his say on it. And a little bit gutting, man. You know, I don't know if you got to read it, but it's been a little bit like poo, Dav. A bit like poo on the bottom of the shoe. And it's kind of stemming back to Gustard being there again, which is a little bit of a shame. It seems like that regime just did not ever get going. It just sounded like a real mess. It's, you know, I think my opinion on Quinns is a little bit weird. I don't think they're an easy-to-coach bunch. I think there's just an air about that club of, not quite arrogance, but there just seems to be, like, a difficult vibe to manage. Yeah, and I don't think if they don't like you, that's it. You're out, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. We can't possibly comment on the inner workings of Quinns. I think from the outside, they seem like they're the fashionable club. Like, if you want to be... They're like Stade Francais in France. They're like the sort of the cool club to be at. Like, I think Harlequins are the closest thing we've got in England. They're not quite as flamboyant. But
they got a funky kit.
They do, but it's been the same funky kit for hundreds of years. They haven't got like modern art on there like Stade used to have. So maybe they attract a certain kind of player, but I don't know. Like, we can't possibly say what's going on in there because we don't know. It's a shame to have a club legend. Was it like 300 games plus?
348 games, 98 tries.
Yeah, England international. The kind of guy, if you were a more sentimental fellow, you'd say, yeah, we'll just keep him on the books, give him a testimonial year, bring him off the bench to just trot in a couple of easy tries at the end of games or something. Let him wind down his career in a Quinns jersey, but I don't know, maybe they want to, well, maybe they think he costs too much money, maybe he wants too much money, I don't know.
But... Well, what he said is that the week before he got let go and told, he got told back in December that he wasn't going to get a new contract by Gustard. And apparently the week before, Gustard said it was like one of his main aims was to bring down the age of the squad. get a lot of new blood in and stuff like that. Now, Mike Brown's 35. He's been at Quinn's for 17 years, like you said, long time servant of the club. And then, yeah, he just got called in and said, you're not part of our future plans. And a 4-minute meeting is what he said it was. And he sat in his car and got upset and cried afterwards, he said. I mean, a 4-minute meeting for a guy who's been at the club for 17 years is poo, by anyone's standards.
Yeah, it sounds a bit of a shitty way to let him go. Like, I can appreciate wanting to say he is pretty old, and I guess, like, if he's there, he's maybe stopping somebody else develop, and they've got some pretty exciting players in that team. But, I mean, I think there's always going to be a place for the older heads to, you know, guide these up-and-coming players through. Maybe even if he's not, if you just say, look, we're not playing as much.
He's been the best fullback in the Prem this season. He's been the
best. People are talking about him for an England shirt and a Lions shirt still. So obviously he's playing well. But I can appreciate that, like, you've got a plan for the future in the sense of Harley Quinn's. But I mean, where he goes next, it could prove to bite him in the arse unless he goes abroad. He could go maybe America. It would be topical for us.
He's not going to America, Dav. I know where he's going. I've read it today.
Honiton Rugby Club.
If we had that kind of budget, sorry to the lads playing the back three. You're not going to struggle.
Co-signing for you.
Yeah. I'd be promising money that I wouldn't be able to give him, unfortunately. But maybe a few pasties would settle the tide, and a couple of pints of cider. But now he's going up north, Dav. He's going to the Newcastle Falcons. Dino got on the phone, didn't he? Dean Richards got on the phone. He said, remember that time when I was at Quinn's trouble? Well, do you fancy coming up north and causing some more trouble? And obviously Brownie's gone, why not, son? I'm up there. So he's off there, yeah. But no, I think that's a great signing for Newcastle.
That could bite Quinn's in the arse. Newcastle, one of those teams that on their day are very good to watch. Obviously, we did playoffs a couple of years ago. We were in a bit of a relegation battle after that. But they're a team that can entertain and can win a game. If they get a bit of momentum going, he's probably the kind of player, like you say, if Newcastle get into a playoff spot or a Champions Cup spot, probably someone like Harlequins who might end up missing out. So time will tell. I don't know if Mike Brown is a vindictive person. He might just say, well, thanks for the memories. Sorry it didn't work out. Do his best at Newcastle. He might have a bit of a streak about him. Want to punish him next year. We will see.
Well, he seems like an honest guy. And he like I said, that article was pretty nice to read, actually. He's seen a bit of transparency for once. And he sort of said, I didn't want to give the club the opportunity to sort of have their sort of besmirchment of it. But like, clubs tend to just put something very neutral out, don't they? I think he wanted to sort of say it how it was. And fair play to him for doing that, because... Yeah, I don't think by the sound of it, he's been good at all, really. But, you know, best of luck to him at Newcastle. Dean in the market, wheeling, dealing. Got a good player there. I'm sure he'll do well there. Probably get at least another 2 seasons out of him, because he's in good shape. He's always been fit. Yeah. All right, then. Well, good luck to Brownie. Bit bad from Quinn's, but maybe it was all part of the troubled times they had with their recent sort of staffing in there. But who knows? Only time will tell. Next up, what I've got here, just on the headlines, I know it's already been talked up and stuff like that, because it came out sort of last week, really, but Lions tour in South Africa, it is happening in South Africa, apparently. That is the decision. Pretty good. I'm really happy about that. I don't know what you think, but I'm much happier it's happening abroad.
Oh, yeah, I think it's a waste of time having it in the UK. I appreciate that you're getting, well, if there's going to be a few fans in or no fans in, it doesn't matter really where it's played. But if I'm a prospective Lions player and I get on one tour and I play at playlists I've already played, play at home, don't have that midweek thing. Because who are you going to play midweek? Like, you're going to play the Premiership teams? You're going to play like...
Well, what, you're going to fly in the South African teams?
So they ain't going to come here for the midweek, surely. Unless South Africa then you just reverse it and South Africa do the midweeks. Benison, why do the Lions thing? You're making you less likely to win if you're not built like bonding together as a team playing those games to prepare. So
there was just too many red flags, wasn't there? There's just too many red flags. It was things like, if we're playing in Britain, it would be too easy to call up cover. Johnny, it'd be like just calling people up for arrest's sake. It just would have been rapoo.
It just takes that whole spirit of the Lions away. It's a touring team, it's what it's for. I mean, that professional era is, you know, obviously it's the peak of international rugby for people from the British Isles, but it's meant to go abroad. Like, you I don't think it would be sensible to have it in the UK. So I'm glad that's happening. I almost, to be honest, if they say South Africa isn't safe to go to or whatever, I would rather they just postpone it or didn't do it at all. To be honest. Sure. Or just go somewhere else, go somewhere safe, go maybe do a Tasman tour, play Australia and New Zealand in one go or something. Last minute. So that's good news. Yeah, we'll keep that one short because times are ticking.
Yes. So last sort of main headline thing, I just sort of saw this the other day. I'm not sure if you've seen anything on it. World Rugby have announced that they're doing a mouthguard trial to improve head injury detection. So just give you the sort of brief notes of this. World Rugby has announced a trial of a chipped mouthguard, so sort of like a microchip in it, which will be a potential game changer, they're calling it, in improving head injury detection and prevention. So apparently more than 700 grassroots clubs in New Zealand, including men, women and junior size from 13 upwards, are going to be involved. It's led by academics from the University of Otago. Big ups, UOT. They're going to monitor the nature and frequency of head impacts. So this little microchip apparently has got a recording sort of the intensity of impacts. Its accuracy is 95%. So it collects information on linear and rotational motion, location, load and the direction of collisions. So, I mean, for people in general, with a concussion, usually what it is it's kind of like, if you imagine like the brain being like a big sort of pear or something in a jar filled with water, and you sort of shake about that mason jar a little bit, the brain is covered in that fluid, which kind of protects it from gentle jiggles. But when you bang it against the skull, which is kind of what happens with these concussions, that's what causes those sort of micro bruisings and medium size and small tears in the brain. Generally, that's kind of the gist of it. What tends to happen a lot is a lot of the severe brain injuries come from the twist of the head, because when the head twists, that causes the brain to rotate and twist with more velocity in the head as well. So that's what causes bigger tears and ruptures. So with boxers, it's like when they get the jabs and straight punches, they sort of manage those quite well, and they would perhaps maybe only cause like micro or minor concussions. It's when they take the hook punches or the uppercuts that twist the head to the side is when they get the quite catastrophic brain injuries, or the ones on the temple that cause the head to rotate. So in rugby sense, a lot of these head injuries are actually, we're seeing like a knee will catch a chin and turn the head and stuff like that, or a hip bone might catch the chin or turn the head. So that's actually kind of the important part of these head injuries, I think. Yes, we've got to stop the impacts in general, but let's see what the actual impact is in terms of these more severe sort of motions that are related to causing more chronic head injuries. And hopefully this is what this data will do.
Right, it sounds very positive. I think, say, you have that data, you maybe can see what kind of movements, what kind of impacts are causing the worst injuries, and maybe the law makers can then make better decisions on, well, what is actually causing concussions or the worst concussions, etc. And you can say outlaw maybe, you know, but you know, look to control certain things, or at least at the very least you pass that information down to, you know, coaches, teams, clubs, players, and they know what kind of what they can do to protect themselves and each other when playing. You know, if you know that you're tackling with your face is something that some people would have to do. They just want to make the tackle and they get injured that way. But if you know, like, you know, certain ways of going in, like your body, the way you go into a tackle, the way you clear out a ruck, the way you carry the ball, you can protect yourself. Mm. And you know how or what kind of thing to avoid, then that's positive. And I guess physios and whatever, you know what you're looking for in terms of, you know, the head twisted a lot as he got a knock, that could be potentially worse. So I think it's good. With that, yeah, and the spit test, it's positive stuff in the world of concussion.
Yeah, and as well, you know, it'll just help, I think, inform some changes to how they train and stuff like that, because people have talked over for a while about dropping like training load in terms of contact exposure. And it's something that you've heard a lot of fighters in boxing and mixed martial arts talk about in the last year who've had a lot of success. They said, well, I don't actually spar anymore. Like, we do very light kind of touch sparring. I don't actually go hard in the gym anymore, sparring wise. So they're never sort of carrying any sort of general head knocks or anything like that. They've completely reduced that risk. And it means when they come into the fight, they're a lot clearer and ready to go. So hopefully that'll inform things. This could be, you know, as big a finding as, you know, research into things like dehydration and stuff like that have been on performance. You know, this could be a real big game changer. And just sort of cap it off, apparently the RFU have announced they're going to use the chip mouth guards in the Premiership from next season to monitor player load in training and matches. And apparently three clubs in the Prem already use them. So I didn't realise that. They use instrumented mouth guards already. Tigers, Quins and Gloucester. They use the Protect system, that's spelled Protect. If anyone wants to check those out, and they're made by Sports and Wellbeing Analytics. So yeah, that's definitely something cool to look at. I think game changer is probably the right word for it, isn't it, really?
Definitely, it could be. I mean, if it's something that we can protect players and say the worst consequence of these concussions can be mitigated, then that's obviously fantastic news.
Wicked. All right, that's everything. Do you have any other sort of last minute headlines, anything you've seen,
heard in the last day or so? I don't think so. No, not that I can remember. Not that we're not going to cover in this next section.
Yeah. So main feature.
What is this week's main talking point, Daniel?
Well, this week, so we had a little discussion today, obviously, with the Women's Six Nations starting this week and, you know, women's rugby being on a massive rise over the last few years and us having an interest in getting it involved in our project. It's just felt natural to give that a bit of, you know, extended time, a good sort of main feature on a pod, and really sort of talk about some key areas in it, you know, progress that's been made over the last few years, the sort of perceived quality level and the actual quality and skill level and physical attributes that have been, you know, coming into the game the last couple of years, especially. Look a little bit into things like pay dispute and equal pay and stuff like that. Look at what we can do, maybe what the next steps are to grow the game from here. What would we do if we were in the driving seat? As well as touching on maybe some little more testy topics, but we'll get to that when we get to it. We'll see how that handles and how much hatred we get and how many people we potentially annoy. But first off, man, I mean, the progress that's been made in the last few years is pretty great to see, really, isn't it? I mean, even just the last sort of, from the last World Cup. I mean, that World Cup was a real sort of lift, the one based in Ireland there, wasn't it? That's been a huge climb, really.
Yeah, it has been astronomic, you could say, the rise of women's rugby. You think about it, like, when we were growing up watching it, well, not watching it, precisely we weren't watching it, but we were watching rugby. It wasn't on ever. Like, you might hear about it, they might do a little bit of a cover in like Six Nations coverage. You go, oh, the women are also playing, and England won 63-2 against Wales. Eagle-eared among you will recognise I said two, and that's not possible to score in rugby union. And I mean, I couldn't name a player really. Like, I know we were playing at Hinkley, and there was a couple of people around Hinkley had played for England women, but that didn't really mean anything. Like, other than that, Vicky McQueen / Mazzarella played for England. That's the only name I pretty much know. But now, obviously, there's some sort of genuine stars, I guess, in the England team. Obviously, Maggie Alfonsi sort of retired now, but then I guess Emily Scarrett's like the big name, as you will. But there's, you know, a few more now, and it's growing and it's becoming a bit more household, which is good.
Yeah, I think a lot of like the marketing side of things has been a real big shift as well. I think, you know, the rise of things like Instagram and stuff like that have really played a hand into it. It's made it a lot more accessible to young women. You know, the fact if it's not going to be on telly often, and the fact that we've only just really got this professional league, which is growing in terms of people going and watching it, which has kind of always been a bit of a problem for rugby anyway, getting people to go and watch, because yes, we get good attendances at a lot of premiership clubs and that, but a lot of guys who are into rugby actually play it. Whereas a lot of young guys who are into football go and watch football over playing it on Saturday. They probably tend to play on a Sunday more often. So there's always been that kind of difficulty there. And I think it's the same a lot for women. Like a lot of women who are into rugby play, so they kind of miss that opportunity. So I think the accessibility that's come from these platforms like Instagram and stuff like that have made it really easy to become more famous. I think, you know, the like, you know, Emily Scarrett and that now have got so many followers and people looking at their stuff from around the world. Whereas before that would have been quite difficult. So I think it's been great that the women's game's been able to sort of latch onto that especially and go from there. And you're starting to see, yeah, a little bit better from our main broadcasters, you know, are starting to reach out to a little bit more. The Premier 15s was a great addition and a really good idea. Getting a professional league in place was key. And I think that's probably been the key point. That alongside the exposure has just been a really good move since the sort of last like 5 years or so since it's really started getting going.
Yeah, well, I'm 100%. On the point of broadcasters, I have a bone to pick with the main broadcasters, is that the BBC this weekend, and okay, credit to them, they have the rights to the Women's Six Nations. They showed it on the iPlayer or on the red button, which you would have to sort of, unless you'd have to know it was on and go out your way to go and watch it.
Well, so I can only assume something really important, like breaking news or something like that was on BBC One and Two at the time, Dev, so they couldn't put it on.
You'd think so. But on BBC One, at the time when England played Scotland, the Calcutta Cup in women's rugby, money for nothing. The show where people do a bit of restoring of bits and sell it on, deemed got top billing over top class international sport. Wow. And when you think that, the BBC, to be fair to them, they do very good sports coverage. They do the athletics very well, where they give the women, obviously, they get very good, equal billing in athletics. They do Wimbledon, again, same thing. Women get the equal billing. But rugby, no, you've got to know it's on and go out well out your way to find it. You're not just going to attract a new audience that way. And let's be honest, money for nothing is poo. The only people who watch it are people who just watch BBC One all day anyway.
Well, I'm surprised that they didn't just roll Guscott and Co. out for the coverage of the Women's Six Nations and put it on BBC One, because they probably know as much about what's going on with the women's game as they do the men's game outside of the England game that's happening at the time. So I don't agree. I think BBC's coverage is lacking, to be honest, in that regard. And they've shown it by not having it on. So, that is disappointing, really.
It's very disappointing. Shout out to long-time listener, first-time content suggester, Adam Grucock, who I was on the phone to whilst watching the England-Scotland game, who pointed this out. Money for nothing got top billing. That's a load of shit. And it is. So if you're listening, the BBC, get your act together. Put it on BBC One or BBC Two. When it's on, just show it live on TV. People will watch it if it's on. What's wrong with you?
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the issue. And it's a little bit difficult as well, because I think in the bubble of rugby, it's hard to not understand that rugby's not actually that big in many ways. Like, it's not a huge player in a lot of the times. And women's rugby especially isn't as huge a player as men's rugby. It's just how it is. It's the same with football. But yeah, if you're not going to get it growing unless you give it that coverage. And yes, it's been accessible, but it could have been accessible through YouTube as well.
Mm. Yeah.
And it has been on YouTube before. And a lot of the Tyrrell's, Premier 15, sorry, is on that. So it's like, where do we go with that? I mean, you've got to give it some headline act, otherwise it's not going to get as many viewers. I'd love to see the viewing figures from that, actually.
Yeah, I don't know if they publish iPlayer thing. I'm sure if you really want to find out, you can, but I don't know how. But obviously, if you think like, oh, there's a 13, 14-year-old girl, bored, nothing to do, just channel surfing and sees live women's Six Nations, you go, oh, what's that? I'm a woman. And then they see all these role models go, oh, all these women being badass, trucking over the top of each other, athleticism on show, skill on show. Because it was a really good game, by the way. I don't know if you watched any of it.
Yeah, I caught the short clips. England were strong.
England were very, very good. But Scotland, as much as they only scored 10 points, there was good skill on show. And it's an entertaining product. Women's rugby, at least elite level women's rugby, is very good to watch. It's not as bogged down with a lot of the physicality and sort of attritional nature of men's test rugby. So it's kind of like rugby was like 25 years ago, where it's a lot of like free-flowing running, a lot of agility, a lot of speed, and that sort of thing is more like advantageous than like size. And obviously with women, you're not going to be able to build like freaks the same way that you get with the men. I genuinely enjoyed watching it. I will keep an eye on it the whole time. But it's, that's not given the chance. And you're going to get rugby fans who probably have nothing else on and go, oh, what's the women play? And you get some people with some backwards attitudes, but they might have the mind change. That was a really good game of rugby. I think it's a shame it's not on proper TV, because it should be. But it's a good product. We'll talk about the quality of women's rugby in a minute. It's good that it's the BBC have got it, but I think they've got to do more for me to get it out there.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that was a little bit of a shame is obviously that the World Cup this year got cancelled. Hmm. So the World Cup, they've just cancelled it. And like, I think a few people made the point, like, would it have been cancelled if it was the men's? And probably not. And I know we'll discuss this in a moment. We're talking about like equal pay and stuff like that. And I guess that's just the issue they've got at the moment. I think it is, without just saying like, oh, tough, it is what it is, you kind of have to acknowledge that a little bit, that let's be honest, like, rugby's only been professional in general since 1995, so the men's game is only in its 26th year of professionalism itself. So that's still growing. And if you look at the men's game, if you take yourself back for the men's game, we're in a weird state at the moment, and it's not financially secure in many ways. And there's a lot of instability. And like you said, there's a lot of, the game at the moment is very physicality centered. The skill level's dropped out of it a little bit. So it kind of is nice to sort of sift through a little bit and see that more pure version of the game in some ways that a lot of people keep banging on about that they want to see in the men's game. Well, if you want to see that in rugby a little bit more, aside from watching sort of lower level men's rugby, if you want to watch them on a Saturday afternoon on the telly, then yeah, you're right. That is the product to watch, is the women's game, because there is a lot more freedom. It isn't so much collision based, because with all due respect, that attribute isn't there as much. And because they're professional, but they've not quite had the professional level that men have had yet. So maybe the physical attributes aren't quite at the same scale. So, but that makes for a much more entertaining product and a much better game. And I think that kind of is what we have to accept a little bit there, the point I'm making, that they're not quite at the same level as the men yet. So things aren't, it's going to be a bit of an uphill battle at the moment. So all I would say is to any women who are listening, is just keep trucking, you know, keep pushing on, because, you know, yeah, they're not going to put you on TV straight away, but fuck them. Keep pushing because eventually it will be. And, you know, rugby is a struggle sport anyway. There's a lot of problems, which I'm sure we'll keep banging on about episode upon episode, but like, the women's game is kind of a really good beacon at the minute. I think it's exciting because it's very sort of new and it's very pure. There's a lot to do with it. And I kind of hope it doesn't go too mad on the physical side, because I love where it's at the moment. If we can just keep building on those things that are good, it'll be really, really entertaining.
Yeah, I think 100%. I think you look at where women are, or the women's game is at the minute, and I think, like I say, with women just physiologically, you're not going to be able to get like 130 kilo forwards who are wrestling, like, just like, even strong like women are going to be like, not slight, but they'll be like, the bigger women are going to be playing, say, front row props, forwards, they're going to still be like, they're going to be fitter and stronger, but they're not going to be that like 50 minute 130 kilo prop we see in the men's game. They're just going to be strong, and they're going to be, with that, they're going to be quick and powerful. And I think you can really make development in the skill side of women's game. That's where the women's game, I think, is going to improve massively, is just that time. Hopefully, we're going to get better coaching for younger girls and more opportunity for younger girls to play more rugby when they're younger, and just develop those skills, the handling skills, the tactical skills, kicking skills. And we're just going to see the quality just shoot up to where the players, okay, I mean, when people try and compare men and women's sports, certainly something like football and rugby, like these kind of games, comparing them like for like is ridiculous. The idea that, like, oh, the men would beat them, of course they would. Like, there's no point comparing them. But in terms of the technical skill that the women can have, there's no reason they can't be right up there as well. Just not quite having that same physical stats. But I think, like you say, for in terms of entertaining product, I mean, that's probably a good thing. Like, there's more emphasis on that speed and agility than there is on just wrestling matches. And that's good to watch.
Well, let me put it this way. Sometimes you watch a heavyweight boxing fight and it's amazing. There's a big explosive knockout and stuff like that. It's great. Sometimes you watch it and it's crap. It's very slow. Two big lumbering guys just throwing bombs at each other. And you notice that there was a welterweight fight on the card and it was incredible. Same sort of thing. And I think, you know, I saw Eddie Jones make a really interesting point a little while ago about saying keep the women's game amateur except for the England. So pay the England players, but don't keep, have a Premier League, but don't pay them. Keep it amateur or semi-professional, because that would stop them from going to that level. Because I think he's bang on. That is what has happened in men's rugby. That, you know, you're able to have a budget where you can have a 50-minute prop and replace him with a 30-minute guy who's going to be explosive as this guy at the start, because you've got the financials there. So I think with the women's game, grow it financially. Steadily, let's make sure that these women have got enough to live on, and it's viable for them to choose this career path, because that's what's going to inspire other girls to take that option. Because let me put it this way, if it's a choice between an office job and playing sport, I think that's an easy decision for a lot of people. But be careful, because if we do dump a lot of money into it, not needlessly, but if we do dump a lot of money into it instantly and people start getting massive salaries, we get the problem we've got with the men's game now, where people are demanding bigger and bigger salaries that clubs are struggling to afford. And you also have the issue where, because there's a lot of money, there's bigger sports centres, better facilities, elite level nutrition and stuff like that constantly day in, day out, where the size will become a factor, because as soon as one team starts doing it, another team has to do it to stay at that level. And then it just becomes, everyone's like, all right, who's the fucking biggest and who can arm wrestle the hardest? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I agree with you, man. I think we've got to have a little bit of control over it if we can. And I think, let it grow slowly.
there's a risk as well with the professionalism of falling into the trap that I think the Women's Super League in football has, where the traditionally women's football was quite, I think it was very amateur anyway. Obviously, there's been a big rise this year, or not this year, but recent years of professional women's football. But what's happened is the big clubs, the Man Cities, the Chelseas, etc., the Man U's, have never had women's teams before. They've started women's teams, ploughed money into it. Yeah. And good in a way, yes, okay, there's these like facilities, and but it's just branding for them. I don't think that the heads of Man City care about growing the women's game. It's branding. They, well, women's football is growing. We want to get in there, be an early adopter. But I think you fall into, so they've got that trap now, I think, where now the Women's Super League is becoming, like, instead of growing into a, like, you know, European powerhouse league like the Germans and the French have always had in women's football, it's not artificial, but like they're buying foreign players in and foreign stars, and they've not grown the local game necessarily, and they don't necessarily give that opportunity for local girls to have that pathway into professional sport, because the top, was it 8, 10, 12 teams in the WSL?
Yeah.
They're full of a lot of foreign players. And okay, you want good talent over here. Like Alex Morgan signed for Tottenham for a short amount of time. And okay, she's a big name World Cup winner, but you know, that's all well and good, but I don't think Alex Morgan's a draw that you're going to get like 20,000 people going watch Tottenham women play. Like the same people are going to turn up. You may as well give that opportunity to the girls coming through. I personally, and I think if the Premier 15s becomes this like super pro league again and clubs start chucking money at it, well, is it then going to be a case of the Kiwis and the Aussie girls are going to start coming here to play for a bit of cash because they are the better players, and you force out local girls, young girls who have got a chance to come through, and maybe they don't get the chance to develop? Because I mean, there's a gap between Pro 15 and then everybody else.
Oh yeah, the gap is pretty big. But I think, you know, I've seen some really talented female players over the years coaching, you know, within universities and stuff like that, and seen in general. So there's a lot of talent there, but it's a lot of raw talent, like you're saying. It's going to take a while. I think we've got to look at this as a project overall. And I think, yeah, I think not closing it off to that talent, but controlling how much of it comes in is going to be important. And it's because it's a bit of a shame for the foreign players as well, because they will earn more money in England, because there just is more money for sport in England than there is in New Zealand and Australia for many reasons, you know, for their sports especially. So it's a real shame for them, because it's like this nice sort of beacon of like professionalism for women's rugby's opened up in the UK. And it's like, right, I want to go there and earn my cash. But if it's going to, like you say, affect the local pool or the financial side of it, then it's a really difficult balancing act. So I think they are in a position where it's balancing it out. And I think the other thing with that side of things, like the marketability side of things and stuff like that, is, you know, it's not great. And there are certain advantages to it, but a lot of the time, a lot of these sports, because the viewership, it'd be interesting to see what the viewership is split is between men and women for the women's sport and stuff like that, because I think a lot of the time there is a marketing edge for, you know, they will push forward the more attractive girls and stuff like that, who are viewed as more attractive in the eye and stuff like that. You see it quite a lot in the UFC. It's a big criticism of martial arts and the UFC in particular, that the sort of more attractive girls, quote, seem to get pushed more towards bigger opportunities quicker, even if they're not at necessarily the best skill level. So they might get a title shot a bit quicker because they're more attractive and they're more marketable for a pay-per-view card. And you have to take that with a pinch of salt, because that is where they make their money, on pay-per-view, you know, and you have to sort of, and that will increase the marketability of women's fighting a lot more. It might help them notice the other fighters who aren't getting that kind of shot. And I think, you know, I don't think that happens so much in women's rugby, but I think it's kind of a pitfall where things can go a little bit. But I really like this angle that women's rugby's had with body acceptance and stuff like that, because rugby's always been championed as a game for everyone anyway, all shapes and sizes, and women's rugby especially champions that. I think guys don't tend to care so much about that. You know, if a guy's a bit more, you know, a bit more beat up looking or anything like that, no one really cares. But, you know, I think with the women's game, they've sort of said, look, we're not taking this as it is. The Irish girls and co had a real big fallout with their union because they didn't use players for the advertising campaign. So they fought. I think there was a misunderstanding there, but it was important for them, I guess, to take that stance and say.
Well, I remember that thing that when that came out, and that was, I think they made a really good point that was made, to say that they had the Irish players, but there's, again, it's no chance to build stars. But say, what's the use of having these random models wearing the playing kit? Just, you've got 23 girls plus who wear that kit for a living. Like, put them in there, they're relatable. you know, yeah. If you're a fan, you're going to see that you're there, so and so. It's a big deal. And like that, it's obviously that's something, it's a bit of a backwards attitude you don't want to fall into. You know, obviously it's the most ridiculous example, but they've had, you remember the that lingerie American football thing?
Yeah.
Which is, yeah. I mean, obviously we're not talking that extreme, but like you say, if it comes down to marketability, is there a girl who's a little bit prettier and we'll pick her, you know, to pick in this fairly exclusive professional league because, you know, resources are limited. You don't want that to even be a possibility, and you hope the people in charge aren't thinking like that. But who knows? The RFU aren't
really. But again, it is that sort of double-edged sword, isn't it? Because when you have someone who is in great shape and is you know attractive and has a really good personality, like an Emily Scarrett, who also happens to be the best player on the planet, you know. Amazing talent, it works well for it, because that is a really good marketable thing, isn't it? Because it's, you know, here's this person who, yeah, people will think they're beautiful and be really amazing, aspire to be like them, and it works as well. But I think the balance that they've had has been really good, and I will say that of the women's game, the balance in general of promoting the whole squad and not sort of, you know, just going on one show pony and stuff, that's been really good. And I think, but also celebrating the success of people like Emily Scarrett, who, as I sort of said, has been like the best player in the world for the, you know, last 2 or 3 years, really is important as well. So I think it's the overall scope for women's rugby. There's a real balancing act with the financial aspect, the progression element, and also the sort of, you know, overall playing standard of the division. Because, you know, there's been a couple, you know, there's not too many runaway teams in it. There's quite, you know, there's competitive towards the top end. I know the Darlington Sharks team's really struggled this year. They've not won a game. They've had a lot of big scores put on them, but I think they performed pretty well this week. And I think they went down 24-14 to Wasps, I think it was, which isn't no mean feat at all. Wasps are quite an established side. So there is a bit of a gulf there. And like you said, that kind of happens with the women's football as well a bit. There seems to be the team that comes up from the championship level gets smashed about a little bit. So hopefully it's something that can work on, you know, and can build up a little bit more. Because I know there's a lot of great feeder clubs out there in England. You know, the likes of Lichfield, for example, are really sort of positive, you know, in and around our area in the Midlands where we're from originally. It is a really strong club for that. So, yeah, it's just getting the balance right, I think, is the big thing for them. And just understanding where it's at, that it's not going to accelerate to be as big as the men's game until that following is there. Until you can get as many people turning up to a game, it will never be at that level. And I don't think it will be for a long time. But we have seen the success in France with 20,000 people turning up to a game.
Yeah. I think so, there is a sort of a chicken egg situation with it, though, where it's a cash thing. But, you know, you go to a men's international at Twickenham, and there'll be like a Bollinger tent, and the match will be sponsored by such and such financial services. There'll be, you know, probably millions and millions of pounds have been just for that one any given match. They obviously, with the Six Nations, the men's is sponsored by Guinness. It was RBS before that.
Yeah,
big money in the women's Six Nations doesn't have that same level of sponsorship. You go to a women's game, there's not going to be like a Bollinger tent outside where they're giving away champagne. There's not going to be some massive financial services company that sponsored the ball, or, you know, the Autumn International was sponsored by some faceless no name company that I've never heard of, but they do it for a while.
Quilter, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even give a shit.
They're insurance, aren't they? Something like that.
I don't know. They have an umpteen of them over the years. But, you know, all of a sudden, let's say a Quilter, whoever they are, they dump 20 mil into England's, in some Autumn Internationals, and say, we want to sponsor this at Twickenham. The RFU will do it, and they'll put it on TV. And that's exposure. And they can say, we want this being promoted. We want this being, you know, the money comes and then it will grow it. And it's hard to say they've got to earn the money themselves, because I think almost men's rugby has obviously had that history of private schools, people going into businesses with a bit of money to throw around. They'll go, oh yeah, I'll sponsor England because it's a day out for me with my mates. And I used to play a bit of rugby at school. Whereas with the women's rugby, they probably don't have that kind of connection. So the money can come that way, and then that's going to raise the profile by almost by force. If that happens, you know, if there's anybody out, because obviously women's sport is kind of really being grown, and that whole idea of like women's empowerment is really becoming quite fashionable, is maybe the wrong word, but you know what I mean, like mainstream. That whole like, well, mainstream, but like companies kind of jump on that bandwagon. Bandwagon again, it's not the word I mean,
it,
but you're like,
yeah, but it, well, it looks good to support a cause, and if you do care about it,
they kind of try to not exploit, you know, I mean, they use that cause to try and sell Skittles or whatever. Like, if they say, okay, we're going to make that leap and we're going to spend that money on these England games or these, you know, Six Nations or the World Cup, that's going to push it up. And when the money's there, then all of a sudden it's going to revolutionize that game. Then, so we'll see how that develops in the future. It's a weird thing to say money. They need to raise the money, but at the same time, they need almost like the gift of the money to push them there. They're not going to be on the iPlayer, and you have to dig them out to find them if, you know, someone's dropped a few mil for them, you know, to be.
Well, I think overall it's going in the right direction in terms of, you know, people are talking about it. It's getting on some platform on TV. Like I said, it wasn't when we were younger, sort of 10 years ago. Really, so it is getting that platform and stuff, so that's positive. And yeah, it's, you know, I know they've played at Doncaster, the last sort of, they played France at Doncaster in last year's Six Nations before the sort of COVID hit, as it had, and they sold that out, and that's like 3,000-4,000 plus, I think, maybe more. That might be wrong, it might have been 7,000. Yeah, I feel like that's the number, but either way,
you're at Doncaster this weekend, it doesn't look that big, but yeah,
multiple thousands of people, either way, you know, a few thousand plus. So that's good. That's income. That's, you know, that is a standard. So that's probably where they're going to be better off. I think maybe we could be talking 3 years down the line. Realistically, let's say they could sell out Welford Road for a big test match.
Well, yeah. Funny you say that.
That's probably the way to go. Twickenham for me isn't the way to go. For me, if you want something to work, you need to not. I'm not saying they've piggybacked events, but they kind of have. It's been like, oh, they play after the game and everyone fucks off and leaves. If you want to do something, you have to do it yourself. You have to say, do you know what? Bollocks to the boys. We're going to do our own thing here. And it's happened in a lot of other sports and a lot of other sort of areas and fields. And it's had a lot of success. So I think if they stick to where they are now and keep building from there, they'll be sound because they're going in the right direction. They've sold out a few thousand at Doncaster for a big game against France, which they've won. They've had a lot of dominance, England in particular. I know we're focusing on England a little bit here, but it's closer to our hearts, I guess. But the unions in general, keep doing your own thing. Try and establish a professional league, even if it's just literally six teams in your country, Ireland and Scotland, we're talking about here, smaller countries, and Wales as well, potentially. Build up from there. Accept that it's going to take 5 to 10 years to build it. Get on the back of social media. Get on the back of these causes and companies that might want to, like you say, use your cause a little bit. Sell your soul a little bit. It ain't bad. And that's when the money will start coming in. And then sell out small stadiums, because I'll tell you what looks better than nothing. Playing at Twickenham and 100 people stay looks shit. Sell out Welford Road or Doncaster Stadium. I forget the name of it now. Castle Park, I think it's called.
Castle Park, yeah.
Sell out those kind of levels. You're in business, because that looks good. To sponsors, to big money people, to fans, that looks good. So that's my suggestion for where they should go. It's quite good. It seems like we've sort of covered these topics that we wanted to cover as we've gone along, which is pretty cool.
That's good.
My suggestion going forward. That's my suggestion.
Well, yeah.
I think you're too dissimilar.
No, I mean, I was on the phone to a listener of the show, Adam Grucock. On the phone watching that game, we were saying, personally, I think there's no reason England shouldn't play some big games at Twickenham, and it's a standalone event. But what I was saying, like, if you play, I think Doncaster, as much as, okay, they sell it out, it's, I think you look at it on telly, and all respect to Doncaster, but they're not a big club. The ground is not that exciting. It's got like one main stand.
I've been there, Dav. I can confirm it's quite nice. And I had a lovely cow pie.
I don't doubt they have excellent refreshments on offer.
And pints of Tetley's as well.
And an excellent beer. They've supported Rugby Union for many years. The Tetley Bitter Cup, as it was many years ago. You know, I suppose the Premiership Cup now, isn't it? But
that needs to go. Let's not talk about that now.
That's a future thing. But, you know, you could probably sell out, I mean, or get as many players go, people go watch the game there. If you get 4,000 or 5,000 there, but you probably get that the same thing at, say, that AJ Bell for Sale. You know, you probably get the same as what Sale are going to get, maybe more. you play at Brand Premiership grounds. You know, there's a bit more legitimacy to it, I think, when it's a big ground. Say Welford Road. If they played at Welford Road, I'd go and watch. I'm sure if they played at Sandy Park, you'd go and watch. The Allianz Stadium, obviously. Allianz Park, not Allianz Stadium, that's in Munich.
Well, it's not anymore. Not Allianz dropped the sponsorship, didn't they?
Because have they?
Very, very naughty boys.
Oh, well, either way, that ground, nonetheless, Unknown Park, is still a good stadium. Obviously, famous stadium to go and play at. These places, I think you go and play, you can spread the game around a bit, so it's not just Twickenham to focus on, but I think you've got to give them real legitimate grounds. I think Doncaster is, maybe it's nice if it is, I'm not going to, you know, poo on that, but it's too small for me. I think you need to, you almost like build it and they will come. If you put it somewhere big, people are going to go watch it. You've got rugby fans. See, Kingsholm, that's a perfect place to go and put women's game. Like, rugby mad out there. Or even say, I mean, okay, it's similar, but like Cornish Pirates, we've been there before. It's kind of like a big round, a big rugby area. Maybe that's no better than Castle Park, but you're spreading it around. I think the fact they play most of their games there, to me, Doncaster's not a huge rugby area. I know they've got, are they Nat 1 now, or are they still in the Championship?
Championship, solid club.
But they're bottom end, not to shit on Doncaster Knights. Sorry if you're listening.
Mid-table, I think. They were in the playoffs a couple of years ago, Dav, when Bristol went up. Bristol beat them in the playoffs. I was there, saw an ageing Tom Varndell and Lemmy on the wings, tearing up.
An ageing Lemmy as well. How long did David Lemmy play for Bristol? It must have been about 20 years. This is off topic. But I think you've got to give the women a legitimate place to go and play. Let's say, Welford Road International would be good. I'd go and watch. I'm sure most of the people I know in the area would say, oh, yeah, let's go watch that. Sounds a good idea. And I'm sure we're not the only people who would agree. Like you say, if you get 10,000 at Welford Road, you felt the Crumbly Terrace, it's going to look good. Like, you can get a decent crowd at the varsity game there, and I've played in that. It's not that special. But we talk about the future women's rugby. I have drew up my own David Nurse patented blueprint of how to make women's rugby excellent in England.
Well, that's my next question. I think the whole pay dispute, equal pay thing, we've kind of covered in that regard, haven't we? Let's be honest, until it earns... Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? Because equal pay and that has come into businesses. So someone who does the same job as you or me, regardless of gender or anything like that, earns the same amount of money. Fair enough. But I think it's difficult in sport to say that. So just because women, professional rugby player, one's a man, one's a woman, they shouldn't earn the same amount of money. I don't think, because it's a much more income-based game, isn't it? It's a much more income-based sport. Whereas a business has its set policies and set salaries. You can't have a salary match in sport, I don't think, because it's...
No, you know, I think there's a bit of, can be a bit of confusion when they talk about the equal pay in women's sport. So they're not necessarily saying they want these ridiculous salaries they're getting, but they want a similar cut. I know sometimes they get more of a cut necessarily, but I think that's almost a pointless discussion to be having as far as I'm concerned. It sounds maybe, I think I'm pretty progressive on women's sport, but basically if you're a woman playing international or professional sport for a job, you should probably be thankful that you play in professional sport for a job. It's the ones who would be, if they're at the equivalent men's level, and there's a Premier 15s players, they aren't fully pro and they're training like pros, but they still got to do another job to make ends meet. That's not really ideal, but, and it sounds like a dickhead thing to say, but I'm not professional. Like, if I could make just enough to scrape by playing professional sport, I'd be, you know, thankful for it the same way, I guess, like guys that play in the Championship are. It's easy to get, I think, your mind warped a bit by seeing these guys who are making ridiculous amounts of money, like in football, where you've got multi-millionaires and players are playing in the Premiership for 200, 300 grand a year in for rugby. And, you know, tens of thousands of pounds match fees for England on top of that. And think, well, that's what we should be having. But realistically, if you're on 25 grand a year to play women's rugby or any rugby, you're stealing a living. I know it's not a load of money, but you're getting paid to not have a job, basically.
Yeah, and I think it's the comparable levels of it as well, isn't it? Like you said, I mean, what I think is, then I'm gonna throw a little bit of a spanner in, because I know you've got your plan to pop up. Just before we do this, a really quick point: would a gimmick be something of interest potentially? Now, a lot of people always point to the Battle of the Sexes in tennis as like one of those examples of like giving women's tennis kind of higher profile. You know, Billie Jean King beats a guy who was ranked 100th or something like that, I think. But it still showed that women weren't inferior, which was the whole idea at the time, like a woman could be a player in the top 100 or something like that. So is there maybe something in it with like the England women's team taking on a men's team, maybe? Would maybe something that would be a big, you know, like to coin like a jokey sort of thing, when Jackie Moon wrestled the bear in semi-pro, that brought the crowds to the Flint Coliseum. It could be something. I'm not saying, I'm playing devil's advocate here a little bit.
That is a strong bit of devil's advocate.
And what would be a level where it would be a competitive game?
I mean, that's where you... I think the problem with this idea is it sounds like a good idea, and there is going to obviously be a level of men's rugby where England women's team would win. But I don't know where that is. And I think you only ever give credence to people who go, oh, well, women are shit. They shouldn't play the sport. Oh, look at them. They can't catch the ball. Whoa. Like those idiots who think that they, you know, sat on their ass going, oh, I'm better than them. Oh, I could play. If I play women's rugby, I'd score out full every game. So I think you almost give credence to that, because I don't know how high a standard it would be. I think there's a difference between, like, again, women's club rugby to the Pro 15, the Premier 15, to then the England team on top of that, where, I don't know, what's women's rugby? If it's England's, you know, 15, I don't know, do they beat... I would probably put it out that they don't beat any of the National League clubs, probably a couple of divisions down.
No.
I think any team I've played in would probably beat England women's teams, which, I mean, I don't know, prove me wrong, but I wouldn't want to play it on the field. I think if you end up saying they play like a mids two team, the mids two team win, then you go, well,
yeah, but no, but yeah, but I think it just it might be something to pull a bit, maybe not a game, but maybe like a challenge or something. I don't know, because
you could do, if you did like a skills challenge, they'd probably fucking win.
Well, look at those Red Bull things with like Jack Noel and Stokesy. How much like from Korea, how much like exposure that's given? Maybe something like that. Some more interesting stuff. Because I think there's lots of great content going on out there, which is really wholesome, and getting to know the women's players, which is great. But I think now I put the challenge out there for some brand to step up and be like, let's go on it. And I think because that's something that we will do with what we're trying to do. Mm. We're going to really sort of push our women's team once we get that going to be really competitive at the elite level tournaments and stuff like that, and be like a little bit brash about what we're doing and sort of confident and enjoying it a little bit, and really sort of help put them out there and let them have real control over what they're doing and express themselves. So I don't know. It's just an interesting point. I don't think it's a serious point I'm making.
Well, I know, yeah.
I just think it's a little bit devil's advocate. But is there something that would be like that? And I guess it kind of leads on to your point about, you know, this blueprint you've sort of mentioned here. Dave's been putting a lot of hard work in for the listeners at home. We have to stall the podcast by 5 minutes recording so that Dav could finish his blueprint. So, you know, he's not turned up prepared with it. So I'm expecting absolute dog shit. But prove me wrong, David. Prove me wrong.
I will prove you wrong, good sir. Okay, for women's rugby to make that real transition to professionalism and really make, certainly at the very least, English women's rugby the beacon of what not just women's rugby professionalism should be, but just professionalism rugby in rugby could be. And I would admit, I have stole some of it from sort of the pre-Super Rugby New Zealand days. But I digress. So, Premier 15, currently they have 10 teams. That's fine. I think you keep that 8 to 10 teams if it's in England. Maybe for the sake of, because there's no like massive disinterested part or conflict of interests in women's rugby the same way. You put maybe a couple of Irish, Welsh and Scottish clubs or provinces or franchises into that mix as well. For the sake of having professionalism in those countries as well. But the players are like centrally contracted. You're not signed for your club. So Saracens, you know, you aren't contracted to Saracens. You aren't contracted to Wasps or Waterloo or Loughborough Lightning. You're like in Super Rugby, you're an NZRU contract and they just basically tell you where to play. It's like that. That you maybe hold a draft or something. Maybe, I don't know, but the players are like distributed, the England players, the internationals, the star players are distributed across those teams pretty fairly. It keeps it competitive. You don't get, so far looking at Saracens have won every season pretty comfortably. You don't get like Darlington getting smashed by 70 points every week, because the games in theory should be competitive. They've all got England household names in the team. across the league, they've all got internationals, they've all got good players, and no team has got a load of them. And you can keep it balanced, because basically a good competition is better than three or four good teams, in my opinion. If the quality's high, you know, because realistically, the professional league for women's rugby, it's not about being, obviously for the girls playing, it's about being the best team in the country, but for everybody else in the sphere of women's rugby, it's about growing the game. The best way to do that is to have lots and lots of good teams. Also, every player in the Premier 15 or the whatever this top division you want to call it, they are also registered at the grassroots clubs, be it a uni team, be it the club they grew up at playing, or just any local club. So, you know, like Lichfield, the sort of team that were a top team but then got sort of shafted for this Premier 15 to not be in it, you're playing for them still. They have a separate season, but it, you run it like staggered, like in New Zealand. So they have like the club season and the Super Rugby season run at one time. So if you're good enough to play in Super Rugby, you'll be in Super Rugby, but you're still registered for one of these clubs that you're not going to play for. So you're a pro player, or you're an England international or whatever. Let's say the season starts in November, because that's when the autumn internationals are. So the club season starts then, and the international season is then. You then have that runs to the end of the Six Nations. The club season finishes, then the pro season starts. So if you're playing for your club, but you're good enough to be deemed a professional player, you then play in the professional season. If you're an international player who hasn't played in this club level, you then go into this pro season. Then that season goes over the summer. For the sake of an example, let's just say April to like July. But that way, I think you've got the professionals are playing at local clubs still. So that grassroots game, if you're like an 18-year-old girl just started playing rugby, like senior women's rugby, or you're at a university and you've got professionals playing with you, they're there, that advice is there. It makes professionalism like attainable. It's aspirational. You can turn up to training at Lutterworth, that's a local women's club. There's not many in Leicestershire, like two or three. You're there, but they've got a couple of pros who are playing for them. You know that, okay, this is possible for me. It's not like a random thing. I'm not sure how they get their teams at the minute. I know they're not fully professional, but like I say, if you're deemed good enough to play at that level, you go into that like draft, you're contracted, and it's not that club has to like financially survive. It's just, you know, the RFU, they're in charge of it. I think this way, you can't, like, the game has grown all the way through. Like you see, if you're playing girls rugby when you're 15 and your club has a couple of pros playing for it, then that's something you can see that you can achieve. And you've got that, like, there's advice with it, and they're actually playing for that club. It's not like it's just a gimmick where they turn up and go, oh, this is how you pass a ball. Like, no, you're training, you play with them on a Saturday or Sunday. I think that's the way you go through. I think that takes away this professionalism, or too much of that professionalism, where it's, you know, the it's too far away and the gap just gets bigger and bigger and it's quite exclusive. You're going to be in a closed shop if it's just England a professional and they've got 30 women. How do you break into it when you're not getting the training time, the nutrition advice, the fitness advice that they're getting? Whereas this way, it filters down and eyes are on you. I know it's maybe unrealistic, but the RFU's got the money to do it. If you ask me, if they want to grow the game, they can do it this way. I don't know what you think. You poke some holes in it. But do you think that's dog shit, Daniel?
I think... That's what's going on at home right now. The listeners, no, I'm joking, man. A very well-constructed and well-made argument. Yeah, I think it's not so much just holes in it, because anything can work. I think it's just the idea of it is, it's just that the challenge is, the problem we have in England is clubs. That's the problem. It's the problem we have in like football. It's the problem we have in rugby. New Zealand, bang on, they've had this whole thing for years where all the clubs help each other out and stuff like that, and they share ideas and stuff. We don't do that over here, because a club is its own club. We want to beat this town because we bloody hate them. We're a tribal nation. That's, you know, we're an island race. That's how we're brought up. That's how we go. So I think the idea would be, it's just the challenge would be getting them all on the same page, the clubs, to share out their talent. Because, yeah, if, it's like what you said before about the Women's Super League. If Man City have put more money into their club, they can sign better players. That's how it's always been in professional sport.
So it's yeah, that'll be the challenge to make it happen, is can you get the clubs on the page to sort of agree to share the talent out and stuff like that?
I think that's the beauty of my idea, is that the local clubs, they don't lose their best players unless they're England players, in which case they're the club of an England player. And you know, like with the All Blacks now, they're still registered to a club. We saw when rugby's first started going again, like Dan Carter turned out for his local team.
Yeah,
the Arnie brothers both turned out for their team, and just like club games. You play in whatever the local league is, because it's not like quite the same way of the national league system we have for men. It's a bit disjointed, but they have those tournaments, and you know, you have those club championships, club, you know, cup competitions.
Yeah, I think it could work.
Even with, I know they have the county teams, which kind of act something like that as well, but they're still useful, like sort of scouting tools in terms of getting the pool of players. You know, are these women good enough to play professionally? And so, because the season doesn't run at the same time, it's not like you're losing players to go pro. If you're playing really well for your club in that season, and you get a chance, you might get selected to then go and play in this pro season, which runs afterwards. So it's almost like there's two seasons, one after the other. I think it, you can't, the clubs have no reason to object to it. If you're, say, like a Lutterworth or a university club, or, you know, any Lichfield, for example, any local women's club, you're going to have all your players still that are there now.
Well, yeah.
Get better players back who aren't in the England squads.
So you're talking about like the draft that would be for like new players coming in to share the talent coming out of like universities and stuff like, or like England age group and stuff like that.
Yeah. You could almost
say like no academies. So like make the rule that there'll be no academy sides. It'll be like club. It'll be like kind of what rugby used to be, where it's club, university maybe, or go straight into a professional club at 18 if you're good enough to be signed, instead of having what we have now in the men's game where you're at a club from like 14 to 18, 19 and get binned off.
Because I don't think there's any value really in that. I mean, I know we're talking about doing an episode about that, about the academy system. For me, it doesn't work that well in men's rugby the way it currently is. I think with this idea that I've got, and it's about growing the game. It's about giving opportunities for women and girls to play rugby. And if they are, because how many women start playing rugby when they're 20 at uni or 19?
Yeah,
probably a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And then they finish uni, they don't really have anywhere to go else and go and play. But this way, you know, if they're good and they're at uni, and there's people looking at them going, oh, are they good enough to play professionally? And okay, that's probably how it works at the minute with the Premier 15s. But when you know that if you just carry on playing, you're going to have this chance, you know that it's very transparent as to how this works and how you can get into this higher level of rugby. You've got, you know, there's more incentive to just carry on playing. Whereas if you take it seriously, obviously you're good. I know a lot of women, when they go to uni, they just play for the fun of it and the social side of it. I get that. But there is obviously a serious competitive edge to most people who play in any sport, and they want to go as far as they can. And I think you just need to have that pathway. How do you get as many girls as possible playing rugby? And the girls who might want to go and play professional will be good enough to get to that height. You've got a pathway for them to go. And it's not a conflict of interest. It's not going to necessarily financially ruin the game, because say everyone's on a similar sort of contract. It's not like you're saying, okay, so-and-so is on, you know, this club. We'll just use Sarah as an example, because they're the best team in women's rugby. They're paying their team like 50 grand a week, a year, all of them. Whereas such and such a club are scraping by, they get like 7 or 8 grand a year and they have to work another job to top it up. Well, no, everybody's centrally contracted. You get sent to these clubs.
Yeah,
maybe the MLS, they have like a designated player. Maybe you can have like two players that are just yours that you can afford to pay if you want to. But I think it keeps the level playing field.
It's interesting for sure. I think that there will be a couple of challenges. Like I say, I'm getting the clubs on board to share out their talent and stuff like that, especially the ones who have got more money. And then I'd say alongside that as well is being able to afford that central contract, and it will involve a big input. But hey, look, we had this investment from like CVC and Premier Rugby. Maybe that would be something they'd be interested in. I think it'd be this idea overall would be a great opportunity to maybe set up a women's super league, kind of like what we have in books for the men's game, sort of men's super league, maybe a women's super league. And that's where you get your draft system from, kind of like an American style. Because like you say, a lot of female players do tend to come from university setup. And then the other ones can just be playing at these clubs that are sort of, you know, elite to scale level, and then they go to, like you say, if they're good enough, they play for the best team, kind of like in like, say, in New Zealand, where if you're good enough and you play for Waikato and you're good enough, you will play for the Chiefs. It's, you know, simple as that. And then maybe if you're good enough after that, you'll get a central contract to play for the All Blacks. So I think it's quite a good idea. And I think probably now's the right time to explore that kind of option. So, yeah, I think watch this space. Someone might steal your idea, Dave.
Well, hopefully you know? They do. If you're at the RFU, feel free to steal it wholesale. But bring me on board as some sort of consultant. So I think the worst thing you can do for women's rugby is just go on this ultra-professional level where money talks and it's about, you know, because I think then you just end up, and I think the Women's Super League, it's almost like it's in football, that is, the Women's Super League, it's almost like I don't think it's that exciting a product because there's three teams that are going to win 10-1 every weekend and that's just not exciting.
Yeah.
And you don't want there to be a couple of teams that put a hatful on everybody and have a couple of good games between them because it's like, well, great, I've signed for Poo on Darlington, but okay, I've signed for Darlington Sharks. We're going to lose every week, like, and heavily every week. It's, you know, you almost it makes it hard for you to build a fan base or to get people interested in that as an idea if they're getting smashed. But, you know, if you know for well they've got, well, three England players plus a few, you know, like local players, there's more reason to go and watch, I think.
For sure. And I think that's the challenge, making it work. And I think it's a good idea, man. I like it. Yeah, watch this space. I'm aware we are a little bit not tight on time because, let's face it, we run this, we do what the fuck we want. If we want it to be long, it can be long. If we want to say fuck, I'll say fuck. I just said it three times in 1 minute. Good for me. Right. I'm looking for something cool to put on.
Get the soundboard out.
I'm going to go with this one.
That was time very for cool.
Time for some MLR chat, baby. So first off, I guess we'll recap our challenge from last week because there was a... Let's go for the scores on the doors, recap our challenge and see who's come out on top. So I totted up the scores earlier on and stuff. So I'm just going to pop on the MLR scores. Major League Rugby Home. This is like the one tab I haven't had open yet, Dev, so my apologies for that.
Yeah, you're making us look real unprofessional. I had it open hours ago.
Why don't you fucking read the scores then, dickhead?
Maybe that kind of language.
April. There we are. April on the schedule. Right, so first up was the Utah Warriors at the New England Free Jacks. That ended 22-21 to New England. Close game there. I mean, closer than I thought. I mean, I know you were talking last week about, you know, Utah being pretty good and they have played some close games before. I just thought New England looked far too strong, really, based on how they played against my beloved Sabercats last week. But
they said they took it was a school game. And they still carried on. Again, Utah been not too competitive the first few years of the MLR, but no, they've, I mean, a 1-point loss on the road as well. It's never easy. I believe it was it New England opening in their stadium as well? So it's a big deal for them. So good for them to get a win, I guess. And Utah made a game of it. Bonus point. So it's the perfect start of the season comes to an end, but it's not a bad continuation for their season, even though they've lost. And New England, again, another second win in a row. They're building a bit of momentum. What were our predictions? I can't remember who I went for.
So, in this game, I backed the Free Jacks and Dave backed Utah on the road win. So, I go 1-0. 1-0 on that so far. I mean, not too much outside. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, so it's a little bit of a fallacy just talking about it, really. I've only really saw the write-ups and stuff like that, but it just sounds like a little bit, another kind of like a or Prem type game where things have gone back and forth a little bit. You know, Utah have done pretty well. They've grown. You know, they were sort of bottom end of the table before, but they seem to have come up a little bit, to be honest. So fair play to them. But yeah, decent home win for New England in the new ground. Utah taking a point on the road. Next up, and what I'm going to put out there as shock of the weekend, Dav, the Toronto Arrows Big win away from home at Old Glory DC. They went to the nation's capital, put 40, bonus point win, put 40 points on Old Glory, who leave with nothing.
Yeah, I can't remember again what I predicted. It's not necessarily a surprise that they've necessarily won the game. Toronto have been pretty good as previous seasons, and you expect them to do a bit better. Maybe it's just a return to where they should be. Maybe a bit of a disrupted start to the season. Maybe they've kind of got, again, not many of them had much of a preseason. They've got their sort of gel together. But 40 points is a big score away from home. I think if I'm correct, again, I haven't seen this game. They've raced away to quite a big lead and sort of obviously just kept it away in the second half. But it's a big win. Bit of a blowout. And Old Glory stopped in the tracks. Had a good start season. That draw away, I think they were draw at home, I think it was to Nola the first week. Win last week, but no, thumped at home to Toronto.
Yeah, I'm just having a quick sort of bez over the highlights now. Got the I'll turn the volume down. Otherwise, don't want to get caught for copywriting. Just looks like things have clicked for them, really. I mean, I had a look at their team. Their team's not any different to what they've named in recent weeks. So they've been really consistent with their selection. So maybe it's just the fact, like we said last week, they haven't had their preseason. You know, the preseason's been affected and they're playing away from their ground. But looking at their team, I didn't realise how many good players they've actually got. They've got Gattis playing for them. And Joachim Tuchelet. So they've got international players, you know, Argentinian players as well there with Tuchelet. So they've got bloody good players. I mean, Tuchelet was a stalwart, really, of the Argentina side for the last few years. So it just looks like, yeah, it just looks like quite an even game. But I think the big thing was, going in 18-7 up at half-time probably is what set the tone. So yeah. From there, they've raced on and won the games. It just seems like one of those performances, really. They went 15 and up after, 20-odd minutes. So just maybe it's clicked for them this week. So, how it happens sometimes, the offload stick, the passes stick, that they wouldn't have done the week before. So maybe they just sort of got over that hill of the previous weeks. Maybe Rob Howley was actually out trading this week instead of throwing dice.
That is finally put the dice down. And we're glad maybe to hear it, Rob.
Well, because obviously, I know they're Canadian, but obviously everything's got to be about America with being Major League Rugby. Maybe in the sort of Rocky kind of type film, it's hit the point where Rob Howley's there throwing dice and Joaquin Tuchelet's gone, "Hey coach, put the dice down, man. Put the dice down."
And those dice, there's no the glory in the is temporary in the dice, but in rugby is forever.
Yes. And I mean, we're writing the this is the script. Get at us, Hollywood. Fucking get at us. And Rob's sort of looked at it. Threw the dice down.
Throws the dice away. And he doesn't look at what it is, but then the camera zooms in on the dice and it's Lucky 7.
Lucky. Oh, nice, man. And yeah, they go on and win.
I think they get a big win away in DC.
Seven tries. I think, well, actually, Lucky 7, I think, is right. I'm pretty sure they scored seven tries in the game. So
Writes itself. This script is fantastic.
It takes us to stabilise it a little bit. But looking at our predictions, we both went for a bonus point win for DC. We couldn't look past the fact that they started poorly. We just thought DC were going to win convincingly. I remember us both sort of saying relatively close game, but
DC started well as well. They scored a lot of points.
But well, just looking, looking at the highlights in the background, I know I watched a little bit of them earlier on, just sort of finishing them off there. Yeah, just looks like one of those days. Sounds like such a phallic thing to say, but one of those days, I guess, for DC. Which is a shame for them playing at home. They've got a nice stadium as well, actually. Some great stadiums in MLR. Really happy with the quality of stadium.
Well, I'll get on to that point when we come to that game. But just stadiums.
Yeah, next up was San Diego at Rugby Atlanta. So the guys from the West Coast coming over to sort of the East Coast area, the mid-coast area, play the Atlanta guys. Ended up badly for San Diego, which was really shocking for me. I was really surprised by that. I mean, I backed a San Diego win here, and David backed an Atlanta win. So, but it didn't go for the bonus point win. So,
no, I thought it'd be a tighter game than it was. Atlanta ran away with it again. I haven't seen much of this one, but the score blind 41-22. It says it looks good for Atlanta. 22 points for San Diego. They've had worse games, obviously.
Well, it was 18-15 at half time. I remember seeing that.
So they've been blown away in the second half. Then it's, I think one thing I've noticed in what the MLR games I've been watching is the second half can tend to slow down a little bit. So maybe Atlanta just maybe a bit more conditioned to pull away, because it's a pretty dominant second half performance, I guess, to run up that kind of lead. I think just momentum seems to go a long way as well. It seems to get on top, they get on top. As we were discussing the game of the weekend, it's quite a few quick fire tries in the games I've seen. Well, last week with New York at New Orleans, it was two or three tries in a short amount of time that killed the game off for New York. They were out of it. So, yeah, San Diego, patchy start they've had. And Atlanta looking decent, to be fair. What's this? Two out of three? They ain't bad. As the saying goes,
Atlanta got a nice setup as well. Like, I had a look at like the pictures that they put from the game and stuff like that. You know, they got like the food trucks in. They've got a nice little stadium, manageable again. Sort of, you know, probably 2,500 to 3,500 capacity kind of sort of setup. Nice sort of almost like a temporary stadium in some regards, but in a nice little area, nice little woodland area around the outside of it. So that's my inner sort of artistic self coming out a bit there, Dave. Yeah, beautiful area, beautiful, David, beautiful. So yeah, no, shout out to Atlanta. That's a big win for them. Maybe a bit of a dark horse for the playoffs at this stage. I know it's difficult for us to make our predictions. I know we've both kind of gone, can't really see past the Giltini. He's probably winning the whole thing at this stage. But
yeah, they are. Atlanta definitely looking in contention. I would not be surprised to see them in a playoff game. Potentially, maybe the big one. But we will see.
Big one. And last up,
the Texas Cup, the Derby, the big one. And
how to approach this.
Tell you what, Daniel, you can ignore whatever Austin scored, because again, for your beloved Sabercats, it's a second big fat zero.
Yeah. The problem's very similar to last week as well, unfortunately. You know, the attack looking a little bit blunt, to be honest. I know we sort of chatted about it a bit earlier on. I watched it before you did, and you were watching it, and I was just like saying to you, yeah, don't expect anything else. You're like, oh, the attack doesn't look great. I was like, yeah, don't expect any more because it ain't coming. And, you know, I think that here's the thing. In a football, like a Premier League season, you can be crap for two or three games in a row, and it's not okay, but it's not that bad because there's 38 games to play. In a competition, a divisional competition, such as, you know, Major League Rugby, the NFL, or something like that, you can't afford to lose two or three games and have two or three poor performances in a row, because it's hard to come back from that. And that's what not worries me, but it's starting to worry me a little bit. Yes, they went out and looked pretty sharp in attack against Seattle, but then to go two games in a row with not getting a point on the board is a little bit worrying. It's a real execution issue. And watching the game, there's, you know, like you'll know as much as anyone playing in the forwards, like when the set piece isn't functioning well, it's an issue. And that just seems to have been a slight issue for a little while. So if the platform's not there, it's always going to be difficult. But I think in open play, the imagination's not quite there. And it looks as if there's no structure for this is how we're going to break down a team, like an identity in terms of how they're going to attack. And that's something that, like, month one of pre-season you get in place. Now, you can say, oh, you know, they had disrupted pre-seasons and that poo, because look how many points other teams are scoring. You know, and I just think there's a slight issue there. Now, I'm getting involved in the Sabercats Nation, Dan. I'm getting involved in the Sabercats community, looking at the posts and seeing what other people are saying, the sort of forum kind of areas. And a couple of people are sort of saying that, you know, the attack is lacking because of the coaching. They'd say that, you know, previously when they had, what's his name? Is it Emmerich? Paul Emmerich, I think, was he's like the GM there or something like that, or something like DOR kind of thing. Apparently when he stepped in as interim coach before, the attack was a lot sharper. So I don't know whether maybe that they've had a bit of a guff with the hiring or struggled to hire someone who's got an attacking imagination, but it looks a little bit unimaginative off of nine, and the playoff of 10 is quite non-existent, really. It's very lateral carry, you
know, yeah, which is, as a
we know that's not go forward nowadays with line speeds of D.
Yeah, as a neutral watching, obviously I was impressed. Austin's pack dominated. They scored three of the four tries between them. They sort of just up front, they seem to be where they got the one, got the win. Really, they took those chances. I wouldn't say Houston were massively second best. it was a very much a game that was played between the two 22 meter lines, and it was like a midfield battle, I guess. But Austin had chances and they scored. Houston had chances and they just fluffed it, handling errors, giving away penalties, things like that. But like you said, the attack, it reminded me of a team I played when I was at uni, where we didn't have bad players. We weren't coached very well to play to any kind of pattern. And we just used to run out of ideas very quickly. If we didn't break that first, like, couple of phases, break the line, we didn't look close. We didn't really look like doing much. And that was kind of what it was like watching Houston.
Yeah.
To use another boxing analogy from somebody who knows rock all about boxing, you know, you watch a fight where it's a pretty even fight, but one guy just follows his punches up and the other guy doesn't. I don't know anything about boxing really, but I've seen fights where people will land a punch, but then they won't follow it in. They'll land the punch and step off, and the other guy recovers, and the other guy will land a punch and land two more, and then it comes down to a points decision. The other guy wins because he just landed those more punches. It was like that. Austin, when they had a chance, they followed it up, and they followed it up, and Houston would do a couple of good bits, and then nothing from it. They'd give the ball away. They'd give a penalty away. They'd fluff it. Again, zero. They didn't have much of an opportunity to take a pop at goal. I think they had one in the first half and missed.
Yeah.
And I don't think they really had any reasonable chances to probably go for goal. But they were like 19 points down at half-time. Worrying. I don't know if it is the coaching. When you say it's coach out, get the banners out like at the Emirates for the 4 years?
No, I don't think so. I just think the thing with it... Well, yes, coaching out if this system hasn't been followed, which I'm going to sort of outline, I guess, for how I see the way to do things and kind of a general way to do things, I guess. But no, if these kind of processes are coming in and they're just struggling, because it does happen. Some teams just struggle. You know, they're not looking at that squad. It's not a playoff squad, I'm not going to lie, compared to what we can see around the league. I don't think it's a playoff squad. But so I do think that will have to come in the future. Playoffs is going to be down the line. I think this season's about performances and getting people to come and watch, and high scoring games makes that happen. And a team that's playing well, I think. But when you're looking at attack and the way I center things about how I structure attack with teams that I work with, is you have to give. So you go two ways. You can either allow expression, or you can set a pattern and go, this is how we play. And these are the moments of expression that we can have. These are where you can have expression. You really sort of kind of like Ireland under Joe Schmidt, in terms of like really structured. The expression comes from the shape, rather than the expression is a sort of complement of the shape. I go down the sort of other route of how I like to approach things, where you give the bare bones. So this is the skeleton for how we want to roughly play the game. This is where, you know, this is the kind of shapes that we want to have. This is what our ribs look like. This is what the spine looks like. This is, you know, this is what the sort of the femur is of
where how the skeleton is shaped.
So this is how things are, but this is what these things represent, and they all come together to make this structure, this overbearing thing. Then the meat on the bones, you know, the muscle, the tendon, the ligaments, etc., is, you know, the blood vessels, is how individuals make decisions in this shape. So I like to have a shape which is flexible, in terms of we can be flexible with it, and it's not sort of regimented to these are the only options. You only hit a guy at the front and he either has one tip on option or carries. There's loads of different options of it and loads of like different sort of things, and your players build a bit of a schema in their head. At the moment, it looks like Houston are working in reverse from that. So they don't have like an overarching sort of structure either way, like this is regimented how we're going to play and this will give you these opportunities, or this is the shape, man, be like, you know, free flowing with it kind of thing. It sort of just looks a little bit like they're working backwards from having that schema of things in their head that they can open up to go, this is the situation, these are things that I can do. It seems at the minute they're sort of going, these are things I can do, and can we fit them into the situation? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Instead of looking at a screen and going, this is how I'm going to play, they're sort of going, well, we'll try it, we'll do this. And the pitch is not there for what they're trying to do at the minute. And I don't know whether that is a lack of structure or maybe a lack of player creativity in their own structure. You know what I mean?
I mean, so to draw that parallel to obviously my team last week, Rugby United New York, they lost trying to play too open. They wanted to play too much from their own area. It's like they forced themselves to play that kind of open, almost structureless, free-flowing kind of thing, and it didn't pay off. Mm. And watching Houston, well, this morning, watching the games last night, it was almost like they didn't have... Either they didn't have like the breaks are off, do what you want. But at the same time, they didn't have anything to fall back on. It was like you say outside of 10, there wasn't much. It was almost like they passed it wide for the sake of it. There was nothing, there's no channels to attack. They weren't looking to attack any channels. It's almost like they was getting it in the hands of a couple of big men, see if they can make it work, and it didn't, and then they had no idea. Someone maybe is trying to get the ball into the hands of these dangerous players, but you shut down a dangerous player. If that's your only weapon, where do you go from there? You have to think, well, they got it right week one. What was the difference then? They had really, really good defence, and then they sort of turned defence into attack from what I've seen in that week one game.
Yeah.
But two scoreless games in a row, it's not doesn't happen very often in the modern way, rugby generally, let alone professional rugby. So you've got to think, do they try something different next week, or do you think there's just they've got to stick with what they're trying and it will click? Or,
well, they've got a tough game next week, and we'll go very quickly through the sort of predictions for next week. We'll sort of rattle through them because I appreciate we don't want to do too mammoth a podcast. We've covered a lot of big topics tonight and a lot of detail, which is great, but we don't want to, I guess, be up all night, even though it's not a school night, Dav. I think the thing is, you've got to find your players sometimes to build the shape around. And, you know, the one guy for me is Viramu Dikila, Dicky Dicatilli. I'm getting that right. Apologies if I'm not. He's the winger. Now, winger is like a weird position. Like, a lot of people are going, what the fuck, Dan? What are you about building the game plan around a winger? When he comes into the midfield, they look dangerous. And he's a great ball carrier. He has played in the centre, I think, this season. They had him there in the game last week. Start playing off of the things that you're strong at. Let's start bringing him off the wing and making those penetrating runs off of set piece into midfield and go from there. Let's get some go forward first and then play some shape from there, because Houston look good when there's go forward, which is obvious any team does, but that's a particular strength for them. When they get relatively positive first phase carry, it opens up the game plan for them. So this week, the biggest thing for me is execute our set piece, get go forward, because that's going to create the game plan around that and bring those players like Dicky Dicatilli into the game early, and then also playing off of Mangio, the number eight, playing off of him as well is going to be important, because those are you guys who, looking at whether the way they play, are the only ones who are really generating a lot of positive go forward at all times. So let's play off of those guys and get some shape from there. I think it's going to be important this week. Just go back to the basics of what gets us go forward, and shape will come from there, and opportunities will come. But to round off the prediction of last week, obviously I went with my beloved Sabercats for a bonus point win. That didn't come off. But Dave was a very smart man and went for the Gilgronies. But obviously the bonus point win doesn't come into it, because that was our tiebreaker points. But yeah, Dav wins 2-1 this week. So well done.
Woo. The title belt is mine for this week.
Well done, Dave. Yeah.
1 point as well, just with the Gilgronies, I didn't realise their stadium is at the Circuit of the Americas, the F1 track. So
that's, yeah, cool. It looks cool, man. Looks
it's
cool.
Like backs onto it, like the Millennium Stadium backs onto Cardiff Arms Park. This backs onto a racetrack. That's cool.
Oh dear, but yeah, I'm trying to find something to sort of celebrate your. I mean, this is the best I can find, Dave. Doesn't even want to play it, Dav. That's how great it is.
Sounds like you're bitter. Sour grapes is all I can hear.
Well, it's broken. The soundboard's broken, Dav. But I'll tell you what I'll do for you, Dav. I'll go wound up. There you go. And then celebrations for Dav. A bit of epic sax for Dave. Well done, Dav. Winner of round one of the predictor. Big result for him, terrible result for me, going down 2-1 there. But let's nice and quickly rattle through next week's fixtures. Let's see if I can pull it back next week. So first off, Giltini's at Arrows. The Giltini's first road game away at the Toronto Arrows, who have revitalised, it seems. Rob's put down the dice. Now they're rolling big wins instead of big sixes.
This is an interesting one. Toronto playing well. This is where you think. Are they a playoff team or are they not against Los Angeles? You think Los Angeles are strong? The only way I think they can possibly lose this is if they are just not used to not having the home comforts of the LA Coliseum and struggle. But Toronto at home, but it's in Atlanta. BP for guillotinies for me.
Yeah, I can't see past that myself. I agree with everything you've said, man. I just think that we've said it before, there are favourites to win it. If I had a tenner to put on a team, it would be them. I think, you know, obviously they've got the guys firing on all cylinders. And let's face it, they've got guys like, you know, Ashley Cooper, Gitto in that team, Billy Meeks, guys who've played like very high level games in pressure situations, home and away. So I just feel like those guys are going to help them be set for that. And I think, again, awesome signings for them. And again, like Van der Merwe, a little bit of niggle there, maybe. They've got a Canadian playing against the Canadian team, the franchise.
Yeah, maybe his countrymen will single him out. Who knows?
Next up, the Gilgronis going to NOLA Gold. So down by the Bayou. Not the biggest away trip for the Gilgronis, but yeah, they've got to go down to the Bayou to play King Creole.
King Creole, but not with the coconuts. For me, I watched NOLA last week. They dismantled New York. Austin did look good today, but previously, you know, they haven't looked fantastic. So I can't look past a NOLA win. NOLA seemed pretty free scoring. So I'm going to go bonus point regardless. I'm going to go for 4 tries for both teams, but a NOLA win.
Yeah, I'm going to sound like a bit of a copycat again. I can't disagree. I think these are quite cut and dry games, whereas I think the rest of the games on the calendar, not so much. But yeah, I think that's pretty cut and dry, really. I think, NOLA are good. I mean, NOLA might be a shout for you know, the finals as well. They look pretty strong. They've got try scorers. They've got something to play for, like we spoke about last week. So yeah, give me them, you know, at home as well, looking strong. So we've got a full calendar, Jesus.
We have full card.
Saturday, so the late kickoff on Saturday, early kickoff here, if the way you look at it, 3 a.m. probably around here. San Diego at the Sabercats. It's going to hurt my heart to say this, but I have a stymy feeling that San Diego are going to win this. And it makes me a little bit sad to say it. I have to go against my Cats, I think, maybe. I'm thinking San Diego. I know they've taken a bit of a tash in by Atlanta. Oh, that's difficult. I think this is quite a hard one to call, actually. I think maybe give me the problem is the Cats haven't been scoring, and this is what worries me. Whereas San Diego, yes, they've been smashed, but they've put 20-odd points on the board, and they've had points on the board every game, whereas the Cats have got to bounce back. And yeah, I think San Diego, for me, will win. It's not going to be a pretty win for them, probably close, but I just think they're going to sneak an away win.
So you've gone San Diego. Ugh, I think Houston have got to bounce back. Okay, like you say, maybe not a playoff team, but they get the win against the Seawolves. There's clearly something there. I don't know if I...
San Diego have struggled.
San Diego have struggled. The road. They're on the road. I think Houston, they've got to turn it around at some point. They've got to put points on the board. I'm going for just a 4-point win. No bonus point, but Houston to win. We're going for your team, which you've betrayed. You've gone against them.
Oh, look, Dave, I'm a betting man, and I hedge my bets cleverly. Last couple of games, a nice quick rattle through these. The Seawolves against Utah. Really interesting game because the Seawolves are 0-2, right?
They are, and they've been not only 0-2, they've been 0-2. Very bad against Houston. Well, they're bad against Houston. They lost to Houston, who have proven to have been not good since. Los Angeles dismantled them completely. Utah, good form. Utah home win. And that also, by the way, we're talking about stadiums. Gorgeous stadium, overlooked by the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
I think everything we've said about Utah, we should take back. I think Utah.
Well, they're still Mormons.
They are still Mormons. That is still true. I don't know if Mormon might be offensive. I think it depends on who you ask.
Is it in Salt Lake City? Sorry, the stadium, or is it outside?
I believe it's near Salt Lake City.
That's quite a nice city by all accounts, I've heard. You know,
they held a damn good Winter Olympics in 2002. That's all I know about it.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, someone's got a Libby, Dave, so it might as well be Jesus with it being Easter.
Yeah.
Utah, a bonus point or?
Bonus point. It's been pretty free scoring.
I'm going to go against you here then, because this might be a chance for me to win this week, to sort of catch you here. I'm going to go Seahawks in just a win. I think it's going to be quite a boring, shitty game in some regards, because I think Seattle are going to make it like that. I think they're going to go to their sort of style of play. They're going to make it really narrow and try and get that set-piece dominance. Utah, they've been good scoring, but I think they've looks got to run out at some point. Their good performances are going to stymie up. They've come close against DC, so I think Seattle are just going to edge them again here. Probably a 3-point, 4-point game, if that.
Also quite as well. Seattle back off the bye week, so
yeah, they are fresh. So they're fresh, you know, and it's not a huge journey for them compared to some of the other ones. So let's hope they can turn it around a little bit. Hattinger and the boys, do me a favour, because I need to beat Dav. Can't go 0-2. Last game of the weekend, Rooney at Atlanta. Tough one to call.
Yeah. Another trip to the Deep South for Rooney in Atlanta. Lost last time out against New Orleans. You think bye week, they're fresh. They've got the star power. Andy Ellis had another full week of training to get his ideas across. So sort of, he's like an assistant coach and obviously player.
I sit on the treatment table.
Probably. But I can't go against New York. I know Atlanta have been good. I think New York have got the star power.
You're going Rooney, though.
Coming over. Rooney, I'm going to get a bonus point win, because I think it'll be high scoring. Regardless. Yeah,
I agree with the high point scoring. Probably looking at like another sort of 30 odd each, or possibly 40, 30 odd or something like that. But I'm going to back Atlanta for the BP win here. Just think there's something about them at home, clearly. They've won their home games. They've been strong. And I think Rooney, the way they played against NOLA, the question is, was the bye week maybe enough to make those adjustments? Yeah. I'm banking on yes, but not enough to win this game.
I think I need to tighten things up for definite. I think Atlanta have looked, say, strong at home and seem to be able to grind out those results. If you're playing too fast and loose, you're going to let them into a game. I don't think they're the team you want to be scrapping. So,
no.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's that then. So watch this space. I've got those recorded. We'll talk about them next week. Yeah, I guess, you know, like we sort of mentioned earlier on, if any of the topics that we've covered today are poignant to you in particular, anything like that, get in touch with us. You can get us at the 99s Rugby on Instagram. You can reach us at 99s.sevens@gmail.com. And you can catch us at our website with contact details and search www.the99sRugby.com. There you go. So yeah, you can catch us there. Yeah, get in touch. Chat to us if we've given you something to think about, or you're enjoying it, or you think we need to do something better, let us know, because we're relatively new to this shit still. So yeah, Give us a shout. But yeah, hopefully people are enjoying listening. Through that website, I'm going to plug it right now. You can donate to us as well. We're trying to get our kit and stuff like that, get this off the ground. There are running costs. You know, Dav's not cheap. I mean, that luscious hair that you can't see.
It's a lot of conditioner.
So if you can help us out, donate. There's a link for our Amazon donation on there. And otherwise, if you're interested in sponsoring us, contact us directly.
And just one more thing. If you're listening to this MLR chat and you think, well, this MLR competition, that sounds fantastic. But who do I root for? I don't live in America. I've got no tie to these teams. Well, we've got you covered. Go to the99srugby.com. On our homepage, we have the MLR Pick Your Team. It randomizes a team for you. Go and follow him. My brother did it today. He got Toronto. He can now be sleep happy this weekend that his team picked up a win. Do the same. You could be happy, or you could get the Sabercats and be disappointed again.
Oh, damn. That was a right jab at the end there. But yeah, no, I've been Dan. He's David. We're the 99s, and this is our rugby podcast. Have a good week, guys. Look forward to seeing you then. Until next time, motherfucker.
Congratulations for sticking it out all the way through that long one. Go check out our partners at the Yarder Collective for any alcohol-free beers, ciders and spirits. You can find them at yardercollective.co.uk. Yarder is spelled YADA. And don't forget to use the discount code 99RUGBY24 for 5% off any order. You'll also be able to find them on our website via our partners page, where any instructions will be made fully clear there. As always, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this week's episode, then share it with your friends. And if you want to get in touch to tell us why we're wrong, you can do it on Instagram at the 99s Rugby, by email at 99s.sevens@gmail.com, sevens is spelled with letters, or at our website at www.the99srugby.com. We are the 99s, new episodes every Wednesday, so until then, see you next week.